Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Welcome to CNS News. I'm Kate Kilpatrick.
And I'm Will Jason. On today's show, Patrick Coleman asks vendors at farmers markets why they're worried about the weather. And Lauren Callahan gets in the ring at a protest over financial aid legislation.
Meanwhile, Veronica Moscoso interviews world-renowned photographer Mark Rebo during his recent visit to Berkeley.
Event that's a census outreach event to the Latino community, and I'm just wondering what the organizers are going to say to people to convince them to fill out the form when they might be afraid that the immigration will come and knock on their door and take them away if they're undocumented and they give their information to the government.
The census has nothing to do with immigration.
It is very confidential. There are up to $250,000 worth of fines and jail time if a sworn Census Bureau officer were to use that information against someone.
The community came out to learn about the census.
Are you going to fill out the census?
I will.
Why?
Why? Because I want to make myself count.
Actually, I think they just came to play soccer.
As the federal government is going to use that information to decide how to award more than $400 million nationwide. But if you're not involved, if you don't participate, that means less money will go to the community.
I'm gonna fill it out because I count.
I got my own census survey in the mail, and after today, I decided to fill it out.
This is Callie Schanefeld for CNS News.
More tape, Tom.
Okay.
I think that looks pretty good. I think you just need to give me a boost.
Okay. Go!
Oh my god, I'm not sticking.
Kate, there's gotta be a better way.
I think you're right.
So, could people ever climb walls like geckos? To find out, we visited the man who basically discovered the now booming field of gecko adhesion.
The field of hairy adhesives or gecko adhesives really started here.
That's Dr. Full. He and his team found that geckos cling by engaging and releasing millions of nano-sized hairs on their feet.
But the toes have these little leaf-like structures that you can see here called lamellae. And those are the ones that are filled with, so it kind of looks like a rug if you were to take the little leaves and put them under a microscope.
Could we make hairy adhesives based on geckos' feet? That's what Dr. Ronald Fearing is working on. His lab created a synthetic version of the gecko's nano hairs.
So what I've got here is, this is like, call it 1,000 times a scale model. When you bend the fibers by dragging it like this, you can see that you're going to get adhesion.
Geckos can turn their stickiness on and off, and they have other cool features too.
It sticks to just about anything, self-cleaning. All these things make it quite a bit different than a conventional adhesive.
Tape is adhesive because it's sticky, but it leaves a residue. This guy doesn't.
So what would we do with gecko tape?
There are so many possible applications for the gecko material. It's probably the only thing you can use in space to really grab onto things effectively. It's just a matter of sort of bridging that gap between the fundamental research and the actual low-cost manufacturing.
Yeah, so some of the challenges are scaling the material up into larger areas. Currently, we're limited to patches about this big. So this is a finger for a gecko glove that we've made.
For now, Dr. Fearing's synthetic hairs only cling to glass.
So what you can do now is, yeah, just tilt, and you can see that the...
Wow, I can really...
So,
I can...
while we can't quite climb the walls just yet, we do have this finger glove, and that's a start. For CNS News, I'm Kate McLean with the finger glove.
And I'm Tom Gorman with the camera.
Here in the Berkeley Hills, very peaceful, very calm area. And we're here because this millionaire, Michel Kapoor, he bought a house here. And he's planning to tear the existing house down and build a new one. And this new house that he's planning to build is very, very large. It's 10,000 square foot. What is interesting about it is that it received a green permit. This raises questions on whether or not size matters in terms of green buildings. Or in other words, can a mansion be green?
I suppose you can build anything of any size green. But if that plot can comfortably fit, let's say, four families instead of just one, you know, that might be a better way to go.
The idea of covering every square inch of ground is just not a very green idea.
I inspected the site with environmental design PhD student Lindsay Baker. Baker also took a look at the plans for the house. In addition to a 10-car garage, it also includes 10 sinks, 2 bathtubs, and 3 dishwashers.
Environmentalists in America have been pretty hesitant to say that you should only have this much space for yourself. Sort of tried to take the stance that, okay, well, if you feel like you need this type of a building, this size of a building, whatever, 10-car garage, then we'll just help you make it as green as it can be. That's really what it comes down to, is that we're trying to make progress, but can it be green? Probably not. It's, you know, if you define green as living within our ecological means, and I don't think this house is really going to do that.
Neighbors here on Rose Street are divided about this issue. Some think it would be better to have one big house than several small units, and others think that this is a very unlikely scenario. But most of them do not want to go on camera. For CNS News, I'm Mario Furloni.
A few days ago, we got a press release for yet another protest on the UC Berkeley campus.
Yet another protest.
And there was a promise that there were going to be piñatas there. What happened?
I was under the impression that there was going to be a wiffle bat. And instead, there was a big punching bag, which was big and tall and red and very light. So if you like just touched it, it kind of just flopped over. And a very small crowd.
A typical morning at UC Berkeley Sproul Plaza. A few early risers, plenty of tables, and a punching bag?
Hi, Hayden. You want to take a punch of student debt?
These students are supporting the Student Aid and Fiscal Responsibility Act, which would include a large increase in community college funding and federal Pell Grants. The House of Representatives passed the bill last September, but the Senate is still working on it. The problem is, Sallie Mae, the loan corporation that controls most student aid, is against the bill.
You know, our biggest grievance is that Sallie Mae has launched this huge lobbying campaign, lobbied a lot of senators to, you know, try to not support this bill, even claiming that students don't support this bill, which is insane.
But for whatever reason, the Sallie Mae punching bag wasn't seeing a lot of love.
A lot of people are afraid to actually take the punch, but Sallie Mae's not pulling any punches.
Many of these students say they're worried about their own rising student debt in the middle of the UC budget crisis.
You know, for me, I'm going to go into a nonprofit field where I'm not going to get paid a lot, and I'm worrying, like, do I have enough? Am I going to make enough to pay all of these loans off?
These students who came out to take a swing at Sallie Mae say they are upset that the company continues to receive billions of dollars in excessive federal subsidies, but refuses to share that money with students in the form of grants.
Many of the students plan to meet this week with members of Senator Feinstein's staff in San Francisco to show them the petitions they have collected and discuss their own concerns about Sallie Mae and rising student debt. I'm Lauren Callahan for CNS News.
We're here at the proposed Alameda National Wildlife Refuge on the former Navy Air Base, and we're with a bunch of volunteers who are working on preserving the habitat of the California least tern, which is an endangered species that will soon be nesting here.
The bulk of the population is in Southern California. This is the northernmost important colony for the whole species.
The California least terns haven't arrived yet.
but they're expected to fly into the refuge at the end of April, where they'll be protected on private land at the former Navy base. It's one of the only habitats they have left. Susan Ewing says that the birds' native homes are California beaches.
They will be in nice big sandy beaches, nice big and open. But people like that too. People like to recreate there. They bring their dogs. A lot of dogs get into the eggs and chicks and that sort of thing.
Every year between September and March, volunteers meet once a month to restore the refuge for nesting.
It's our destruction of habitat that's forced them into this one little place, and they're on the verge of extinction. So if we can help one little colony of animals to avoid extinction, it seems like it's worth a day in the sun.
So basically, what the volunteers are doing is trying to get rid of all of these weeds that are really invasive to the area. And if they let them grow, they'll pretty much take over the tarmac.
Oh, the Dendrochaetia graveolens. It just spreads like wildfire, has lots of seeds, and they get dispersed with the wind.
And the weeds block the birds' view of animals who may want to eat them for lunch.
They like the ground to be really open so that they can see all the predators that are coming. So our job today is just to get rid of all the plants. That way the birds will be able to see really far when they come.
They plan to be ready for April, but volunteers are concerned about the future of the refuge, with the Navy and city figuring out what to do next with the base that's been closed for 13 years.
It takes intense management. If they didn't protect them very well, then they would disappear.
Local wildlife advocates are working toward making the land a permanent refuge for the California least tern and the other species who live there. This is June Stinson for CNS News.
Old Oakland Farmers Market in downtown Oakland to see how the rainy weather is affecting business.
Yeah, it's definitely a slower turnout. It affects the way people go out and conquer the day, I guess. They're more inclined to stay home, stay warm.
It affects things because, you know, people think they're going to melt when they go out in the rain. Just something happens, you know, oh, it's raining.
The regulars that we have that work around here, they won't show up. They look outside and see how wet it is. We do lose a lot of our clientele.
But not everyone shies away from the farmer's market in the rain.
Well, I'm from London, so I don't really care about the rain. I'll just go out, have my anorak, have my hat.
But why bother on such a dreary day?
The best prices. And of course, great company.
I think it's a place where people socialize.
On better days, they have music and people, you know, and more people, no doubt, and a certain time, more vendors.
And what do the vendors do with all the food they can't sell?
If we can't use it, then a lot of times we donate to any kind of charity or food drive.
But not all the food holds up.
Moisture with biscotti makes for a soggy biscotti. Maybe if you have coffee, that's fine.
And it works out, too, because for the most part, it could be a tax write-off, so it works out for everybody.
So even on a wet, cold day here in downtown Oakland, a few people still show up to buy their produce and see a few friendly faces. This is Patrick Coleman for CNS News.
This weekend, you were at the Empowering Women of Color Conference here at Berkeley. Mm-hmm. And I imagine there was lots of interesting folks there. Was there anyone in particular that you met that captured your attention?
Honestly, the keynote, Rebecca Walker, was really touching to meet her. She talked about questioning our own sort of ideologies and dogma instead of just going along with how you're told to think about being a woman or being a woman of color, to see if what other people say and think really works for you. And if it doesn't, then not to be afraid to challenge it or change it.
The 5th anniversary Empowering Women of Color Conference returned to the UC Berkeley campus last weekend. The gathering started as a decal class in 1984. It was so popular that it grew into a full conference in 1985.
I think it's about creating a space for women of color and for their allies to talk about the issues that are most important to them.
The conference strives to build connections among different races, generations, class levels, sexual orientations, and physical abilities.
I want to influence other women and be influenced by women in a positive way.
I definitely appreciated the Olo group, One Love Oceana, I believe. That's a perspective that I don't hear very much from, Pacific Islanders, queer Pacific Islander women.
This year's theme was intergenerational wisdom, celebrating our past, present, and future.
From the committee to the participants, we were able to see the spirit of intergenerationality, which I think really exemplifies what EWOC is all about. You know, these 25 years mean something.
Feeling quite empowered, this is Shalonda Woolridge reporting for CNS News.
He's French, he's 85 years old, and he's still taking film pictures. Since he is such an established photographer, well-known and famous, you know, people from all ages want to see him, want to see what he's about.
Yeah, Mark is, he's very French. Started photography in the 1950s, I believe 1954. When he was a young man, he is now 86 years old, and he still carries a camera, and he still photographs every day.
Yeah, it's fantastic. Yeah. You notice everything is perfectly distributed. I mean, even here to here.
His work has appeared in almost every influential photo magazine, and his images form part of the collective memory of the Western world.
I mean, if you think about all of the things that he did in his lifetime as a photographer, the travels and going to places in which Westerners did not go.
Mark Ribot is an icon. Many people celebrate his photos. Here's what the attendees at the reception had to say.
The composition of the photos, which shows a lot of playfulness and juxtaposition of different elements in the environment that are unexpected but almost comical.
I'm not here to meet him. I just want to be around and see what he's up to, what he's like, what he has to say, what brings him joy, what brings him inspiration.
He's quite a popular man, but we get a minute of his time and good photographer's advice.
To open your eyes, to look. And one day you can look better than another day. And I find I look better when I am in a new place.
And for Rimbaud, even a lecture hall is a new place. For CNS News, this is Veronica Moscoso.
Once eradicated bedbug problem has seen a resurgence in the San Francisco area. But don't worry, there's a new team of exterminators that are ready to sniff out the problem.
No one knows for certain why the bugs are back. Some point to international travel, while others blame resistance to pesticides. To the rescue is a pair of unlikely heroes.
Police dogs smell out drugs, fire dogs smell out gasoline, our dogs smell out bedbugs.
2001. So, and it's been growing from dense urban areas to now the suburbs and the outer areas of the Bay Area where we work.
The experts at PestTech, a pest control service, know that bedbugs are incredibly hard to get rid of. And because roughly half the population has no reaction to the bites, many people don't even know they have them.
It is the human bedbug, and it specializes on human beings. It feeds only on blood. And even worse than that, it expels some undigested blood at the same time sometimes.
Her reaction, she gets excited, her tail will get very wiggly waggly, and when I ask her to show me, she will indicate where she picked up the odor. What would typically take me on my own a couple of hours to determine whether or not someone had bed bugs can take her a matter of minutes.
If left undetected, bed bug colonies can infest entire apartment buildings, hotels, and even offices.
Most of the reason why we fail our treatments is because we haven't identified the true scope of the infestation, and the dogs allow us to do that. To find one bug in a hotel room, for example.
The startup cost of a canine team can reach upwards of $100,000. Right now, only a handful of companies offer this service, but educating yourself on prevention may be your best defense.
So it's about relearning those things, going on a trip and wrapping our luggage again so that we reduce the risk of bringing it back into our space. Those extra measures will really are really going to make progress in the future.
This is Mary Flynn for CNS News.
So tell me about your story.
For my story, I talked to the authors of Game Change, which is sort of a expose of the 2008 presidential election. And, the authors, Mark Halperin and John Hallman, were at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco last night.
So I understand the book had a lot of stuff about politicians kind of behind the scenes of the campaign.
It did. Not only behind the scenes of the campaign, but behind the scenes of their marriages. So
Oh, wow.
Really inside look at the Edwards, the McCains, and the Clintons, and how sort of turbulence in their marriage really affected the outcome of the election, too.
Sounds interesting. Let's take a look.
The Commonwealth Club of San Francisco recently hosted political reporters John Heilman and Mark Halperin, authors of Game Change, the best-selling expose of the 2008 presidential election.
There are a lot of traits about Barack Obama that you see in the book that are both contrary to some aspects of his public image, and I think that also that presage some of the difficulties he's had in office. Important people.
Those difficulties include a growing number of conservatives and liberals who deem Obama's response to health care, climate change, and financial regulation a failure. So how do readers think the Barack Obama that ran for president in 2008 compares to the Barack Obama that occupies the White House in 2010?
I was surprised, actually, to watch during the first 6 months how little of that verve of the campaign Obama brought to office.
I think that the first year is actually starting now because the first year was spent draining the swamp. You know, the first year they inherited quite a mess, particularly on the economy, and they spent most of the first part of the year doing things they never dreamed they'd be doing.
While some Democrats see a president who's lost his progressive ideals, Hallman believes it's Obama's consistency that could prove fatal.
There are times when panic is the appropriate response, and Obama never panics.
With Republicans likely to outseat a number of Democrats in November, it seems Hallman thinks Obama should have a game change of his own.
And he's going to face a crisis unlike any he's ever faced before. And I think the question then will be, does he just keep his head down and try to keep doing what he was doing, or does he make a more dramatic pivot?
He says that shift could determine the course of Obama's presidency. For CNS News, this is Kate Kilpatrick.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.